Now, the CNA 938 World Report.
I'm Benji Hoyer in London.
And I'm Simon Marks in Washington. Today, more grim jobs numbers in the United States, where one worker in four is now unemployed.
China fights back against the Trump administration's claims that COVID-19 was manufactured in a Wuhan laboratory.
Meanwhile, at the White House, one of America's top TV reporters who was born in China fights back against the president's treatment offer.
We'll get an update from Kabul on that horrific attack on an Afghan maternity ward.
Another weekend is upon us with hardly any live sport. How long must the world wait?
And what's the future for Europe's busiest airport?
If you ever fly into an Asian airport, there are health checks that take place every day. So I think that is where we will get to.
We'll hear from London Heathrow CEO.
CNA 938 World Report, the Friday edition, starts right after the news.
From bureaus worldwide, this is CNA 938 World Report. I'm Benji Hoyer in London.
And I'm Simon Marks in Washington. And we begin here today because once again, on Thursday morning at exactly 8:30, the latest unemployment numbers were published by the US government. They were worse than expected. In the past week, another 2.98 million Americans claimed unemployment benefits for the first time. That means there are now more than 36 million people in the United States, a quarter of the workforce, out of work. At the White House, the president's economic advisor, Kevin Hassett, was putting a brave face on things.
The unemployment insurance claims coming in a little bit north of 2.9 million is still a tough number. But the number was better than we expected. I think the fact that we came in under 3 million suggests that the turning on of the economy is beginning, and it's beginning to show up in the data. And so what we expect now is that claims will continue to decline as the economy turns back. I think Americans want their economy back, and the claims data coming in below 3 million today suggests that that's beginning to happen.
But that is not entirely true. Forecasters thought the number would be lower by about 500,000. And many economists argue there is no possible way the US economy can restore jobs at the same rate at which they have over the last 9 weeks been lost. President Trump, eager to see the country reopened, hit out again at Democrat governors who are either leaving lockdowns in place or failing to lift them as rapidly as the White House would like. He told the Fox Business Channel it's all an effort to undermine his re-election bid.
In many cases, they're doing it just for political purposes.
So you think that they would rather see a recession, a terrible economy, joblessness, than have you get another term?
They would rather see our country fail. They would rather see our country fail, and you know what that means, because part of failure is death. They would rather see that than have me get elected. I've driven them crazy. I don't know what it is.
But the president's public health officials, who have no stake in his re-election, are also raising alarm bells over the pace of America's reopening. And one of them, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is now on the president's naughty list after warning at a Senate hearing this week of the health risks associated with children rapidly returning to school.
To me, it's not an acceptable answer.
At the White House on Wednesday night, the president railed against his advisor's caution.
I would strongly say they should open. It's up to the governors. It's the governor's choice. But their state is not open if the schools aren't open. So again, it's had very little impact on young people. And I think they should open their schools.
But as President Trump noted there, it's not his decision to make. And with several school systems now shut down until at least September, there are also indications that even then they may not fully reopen. Dr. Timothy White is the chancellor of the sprawling California State University system. And he says even in the autumn, his colleges will be offering distance learning only.
We thought it most prudent, wisest to plan for 100% and then be able to pull back from that if the circumstances on a given campus prevail. This is a time to lean in. Do not sit out. Nobody can take away the value of a college education. It will be different, but it'll be very good.
He spoke there on ABC, reflecting the reality for educators and students alike. No matter what the White House wants, they are all voting with their feet.
Now to the war of words between Washington and Beijing, which is intensifying, with Republicans in the United States now calling for an economic boycott of goods made in China. Florida Senator Rick Scott says he's introducing legislation that would require American retailers to tell consumers when they're about to buy Chinese-made products.
Any one of us just even consider saying, you know what, it might be a little bit cheaper to buy that thing from China. Just remember, they helped make sure Americans died. They intentionally did not tell us what was going on. They knew what was going to happen. Americans would die and American economy would get hurt.
China is now pushing back heavily against that narrative, using the power of its state media enterprises to accuse the Trump administration of a deeply immature response to the global pandemic. From Beijing, here's Patrick Falk.
A lot of Chinese people are confused, why some are angry.
It's the latest piece of commentary hitting back at attacks against China. Titled Doing the Right Thing, it's described as a view on how the country should respond to accusations and criticisms from others. In it, Zhou Yu from state broadcaster CGTN asks,
have you realized that America has been grabbing every opportunity to scold China from the very first day?
Ties between Washington and Beijing have grown increasingly tense in recent weeks. The Chinese have been angered by what they see as a blame game being played by the Americans. On Tuesday, U.S. senators proposed legislation to sanction China if it doesn't give a full account of the coronavirus outbreak. The foreign ministry responded, saying U.S. lawmakers show no respect for facts and that it was pushing for an investigation based on the presumption of guilt. Hong Kong-based political scientist Joseph Cheng says that's why China's taking a defensive position.
They certainly would accept some kind of general investigation, but not an investigation specifically directed against China. And I think international public opinion tends to favor an investigation after the total decline of the pandemic and that the world should concentrate on the combat of the pandemic at this stage.
Chinese efforts to control the narrative could take a softer tone, though. Scholars and foreign policy advisers have warned the combative approach state media and some diplomats have taken could backfire. They say the aggressive nationalist sentiment could drive the world further away from China.
I tend to agree. I think at this moment, when international public opinion is not favorable to China, the Chinese authorities and the Chinese people should adopt a lower profile, should emphasize on the common destiny of the humankind, on mutual help and so on, rather than to try to hit back at Western critics or try to preach the supremacy, the superiority of Chinese systems, of Chinese leadership, of Chinese tactics in the combat of the pandemic. I do believe that a low-key approach, preaching mutual help, mutual support, and through actual efforts of providing assistance will help China.
But it could take more rationality from both Beijing and Washington for tensions to cool on either side. Patrick Falk, Beijing.
Still to come on the program today, more violence in Afghanistan, a country still reeling from an attack earlier this week on a maternity ward.
When you enter the site of the attack, the first things that you see when you enter the compound are bullet casings.
We'll have that story for you at around 6:45.
But next, the US TV reporter of Chinese descent who's become a lightning rod during President Trump's press conferences. That story's coming up as CNA 938 World Report continues. Welcome back to CNA 938 World Report. I'm Benji Hire in London.
And I'm Simon Marks in Washington. In the world of US television news, there is no higher prized assignment than becoming White House correspondent for one of the big three broadcast networks here. And so Weijia Jiang has not only proved her journalistic mettle in order to secure that position for CBS News, she's also had to rise above the obstacles often placed in the way of women and minorities in the American broadcast news industry. Now she finds herself on a daily basis facing a president who sometimes seems to exhibit some of those biases himself. Our Washington correspondent Jagruti Dave has the story.
President Trump's press briefings are notorious for his confrontations with reporters.
It's such a basic, simple question, and you try and make it sound so bad. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. No, you know what? You ought to be ashamed.
It's such a simple question.
Don't make it sound bad.
The journalist you heard there who drew the president's ire is CBS News' Weijia Jiang. And it's not the first time they've locked horns. Here's the president responding to her question about why he waited until March to warn people of the severity of the virus in the United States and to implement measures such as social distancing.
On the 23rd of March, you said you knew this was going to be a pandemic.
Can I tell you what? Well, I did know it. I did know it. All I have to do is look.
So you knew
all anybody knew it. Just, are you ready? How many people had died in the United States?
So do you acknowledge that you didn't think...
Keep your voice down, please. Keep your voice down.
Their latest clash on Monday has led to the president facing accusations of racism from several of his critics.
He said many times that the U.S. is doing far better than any other country when it comes to testing.
Yes.
Why does that matter? Why is this a global competition to you if everyday Americans are still losing their lives and we're still seeing more cases every day?
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer. Yes, behind you, please.
What, sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you, I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
like
that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Weijia Jiang is Chinese-American. Her parents emigrated to the U.S. from China when she was 2 years old. Commentator Tara Setmeyer, who describes herself on Twitter as a sane conservative, posted another disgraceful racist temper tantrum by Trump because he was asked a pointed question by Weijia. Another critic is Eric Ward, executive director of the progressive civil rights organization, the Western States Center.
President Trump's offensive suggestion that Weijia Jiang go ask China was simply the latest in a string of racist and xenophobic remarks during the COVID-19 pandemic. Weijia Jiang is an Asian American, and her question had nothing to do with China. The president's response is both disturbing and dangerous at a time when Asian Americans are facing historic levels of hate.
Attacks against Asian Americans have been on the rise as the pandemic has spread across the U.S. Grim reports include an acid attack in Brooklyn, New York, to the stabbing of a family in Texas by a man who thought they were Chinese and infecting people with the coronavirus. The president, perhaps noting the backlash to his encounter with CBS News' Weijia Jiang, tweeted the next day, "Asian Americans are very angry at what China has done to our country and the world. Chinese Americans are the most angry of all. I don't blame them." While Donald Trump's supporters defend his comments as simply a criticism of China, many Asian Americans are concerned by what they describe as the scapegoating of their communities. Jagruti Dave, Washington.
Now it's Friday, and as usual at this time, we end the week with a look forward to the weekend of sport. With Germany's two top football leagues resuming tomorrow, albeit without spectators, it spurred more talk from other domestic leagues about how they'll approach the restart of their seasons. Officials from leagues across Europe will be watching Germany closely to see if anything can be learned about kicking off again behind closed doors. Stuart Smith started by asking our sports correspondent Simon Watts about the plans for England's Premier League.
Well, meetings have been taking place throughout this week between the Premier League and managers and players from every club. In fact, they've been invited to have their say on a return in English football, whether they should play at a neutral venue. Also, quite interestingly, whether there should be a rule on whether players actually turn away from one another after a challenge and avoid face-to-face contact, which I have to say has caused quite some debate and ridicule from some quarters among former players and managers after that announcement earlier this week. It's looking increasingly likely that the English lower divisions, the Championship and below, will be postponed, though. Serie A in Italy, it's been announced this week, will resume on June the 13th. And Bundesliga, as you mentioned, returns this weekend. The first games between Borussia Dortmund and Schalke. Meanwhile, there'll be fans of sorts at Borussia Mönchengladbach's first home game, which is next weekend. Now, they've been selling giant cardboard prints of supporters in place in their usual matchday seat at their home ground to try and somewhat replicate them being there. In other sports, PGA Tour golf returns to action in 4 weeks' time. That's after new guidelines stated that players would have to self-quarantine for 14 days if they test positive for COVID-19. The first events are going to be in the USA, in Texas, Carolina, Connecticut and Michigan. Staying in the USA, the NBA is now one third of its way back to voluntary workouts. Miami have reopened their doors this week, which means 10 of the 30 teams now going forward are taking part in on-court individual workouts, a little under 2 months since they had to force playing games and training. One sport that has really captured the imagination of audiences here in the UK has been the Darts PDC home tour that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Now, it hasn't come without problems for the two-time world champion Gary Anderson. He's been forced to withdraw from the competition, or he had been anyway, which sees the world's best players compete from their living rooms and kitchens whilst being filmed on their mobile phones. He had to withdraw because his home broadband was too slow. It has, though, been fixed now, and that means that Anderson will compete this Saturday in an event that has seen the best 100 players from around the world competing in the last few weeks.
And Formula One is set to return in July, but there are already some big changes ahead on the driver lineup for 2021.
Most certainly. Daniel Ricciardo is going to race for McLaren in the 2021 season. It's been a little bit of a case of musical chairs this week because he takes the seat of Carlos Sainz, who's moving to Ferrari. The double switch announced by both teams yesterday, with Ricciardo partnering Lando Norris. Sanchez set to replace the four-time champion Sebastian Vettel at Ferrari. His performance in the 2017 Singapore Grand Prix, it has to be said, is one of the real highlights of Sainz's early career so far. Vettel's departure from Ferrari at the end of this season was confirmed on Tuesday.
Simon Watts, our sports correspondent, and he'll be back at the same time next Friday. Still to come this morning, an update on that deadly attack earlier this week on an Afghan maternity ward. We'll get the latest from Kabul.
And retooling Europe's largest airport to overcome the coronavirus crisis. We'll hear from LHR's CEO. But first, the latest news and traffic. And I'm Simon Marks in Washington. As we noted earlier on the programme, more brutal unemployment data here in the United States has again raised questions about the pace and scale of the country's economic recovery. The White House said on Thursday President Trump will not support a move by Democrats to pump another $3 trillion into the U.S. economy. Kayleigh McEnany is the president's press secretary.
What the Democrats put forward is entirely unacceptable. The president is open to a phase four. He's willing to talk about it. He's mentioned that payroll tax cut several times, but he is very much opposed to the Democrat bill that has been put out.
As she indicated there, stimulus that focuses heavily on infrastructure expenditure is still possible, but it's almost certainly going to be drafted by Republicans, not Democrats. What did all of these developments do for Wall Street? From New York, here's William Denzelow.
This week, traders on Wall Street have digested comments from leading members of the medical community about the dangers COVID-19 continues to pose. The Dow Jones closed the day up over 1.5%, fueled by gains in the financial sector. A Supreme Court decision in Wisconsin to block the governor's shutdown orders helped give Wall Street a boost. The restrictions on businesses could soon be relaxed. Thursday's rally was also fueled by comments from a White House spokesperson suggesting that President Trump is open to the prospect of another stimulus package. William Denslow, New York.
Equally grim business news from Europe as well, with the markets here closing down across the board. The FTSE 100 in London falling by about 2.75%, wiping out many of the small gains made this month, whilst the DAX in Frankfurt and the CAC 40 in Paris dropped by roughly 2%. One of the biggest stories of the day was the insurance market. Lloyd's of London, an institution in the city, announcing it expects coronavirus-related claims to cost it $3 to $4 billion. That would amount to its biggest payout since the September 11th attacks and would equal the combined impact of hurricanes Harvey, Irma and Maria in 2017. The loss could rise further if the current lockdown continues into another quarter. Nearly a third of the insurance losses are expected to come from the cancellation or postponement of major events around the world, including the Tokyo Olympics, which is now due to take place in 2021. Many would-be claimants have also found the virus is not covered by their policies. Meanwhile, governments are facing billions of dollars in borrowing to recover from what former UK Chancellor Norman Lamont claims will be a financial crisis that's worse than the crash in 2008. But fortunately, he says, borrowing is currently cheap.
We are lucky, if I can use that phrase in this context, that interest rates are astonishingly low. In some parts of the world, they're actually negative. Governments are being paid to borrow. That means that we can defer decisions about the deficit, I think, into the medium term. In the short term, I think we would have to let borrowing take the strain.
In France, the Prime Minister is finalising details of a plan to support the country's tourism sector. As summer approaches, one of the most visited countries in the world fears an impact on an industry comprising of 7% of the French economy. Ross Cullen reports from Paris.
Tourism in France employs around 2 million people and is worth more than $190 billion to the country. Edouard Philippe is expected to set out proposals for a so-called Marshall Plan of $1.6 billion to deal with the crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic. France has already seen its winter skiing season cut short and the Easter holidays cancelled, and millions of tourists normally flock to its beaches and major destinations like Euro Disney and the Louvre Museum over the summer months.
Some positive signs coming from the car industry as it shudders back to life. Ever since February, the COVID-19 outbreak in China forced factories to close and sales in the country collapsed. And for months, the motor sector has been in suspended animation in Europe. Showrooms have been closed. Vast factories, which normally produce hundreds of cars every day for sale, have been standing idle. Now, though, a handful are resuming operations, among them BMW, Bentley and Toyota in the UK, with Jaguar Land Rover, Ford and Vauxhall to follow shortly, but Nissan's British operations will remain shut until June. The trend is broadly similar on mainland Europe too, where major manufacturers such as PSA Group, Renault and Daimler are slowly bringing plants back to life, following the example set by the world's largest car factory, Volkswagen's huge facility in its hometown of Wolfsburg. Yet, as business reporter Declan Curry notes, the problem remains that many showrooms aren't yet allowed to reopen, and there's still uncertainty over whether customers will actually want to buy new cars.
It has to wait until car showrooms are reopened to increase demand for new vehicles. Vauxhall's managing director saying that car showrooms need to reopen soon.
The UK government hopes showrooms will be open from June. And that's your business roundup from Europe.
Now, we were hearing earlier from Simon Watts about the outlook for sport, mostly in Europe. But what about the United States? It's a sports crazy country, but it's also a very litigious nation. And that, as Nina Maria Potts reports, is a very problematic combination.
In one area of American life, President Donald Trump can legitimately claim to speak for a large majority of people all over the country.
We have to get our sports back. I'm tired of watching baseball games that are 14 years old.
That was the president speaking a month ago at the White House. He is, like millions of his countrymen, an avid fan of live sport on television. And so far, there hasn't been any. But with millions of dollars in advertising revenues, ticket sales and player contracts at stake, some governors are now making a brazen play of their own.
All professional sports are welcome here for practicing and for playing.
That was Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. He's aggressively lifting the few coronavirus restrictions that he ever agreed to impose and says that for sports teams, the Sunshine State is absolutely open for business.
People are starved to have some of this back in their lives. It's an important part of people's lives. If you have a team in an area where they just won't let them operate, we'll find a place for you here in the state of Florida.
But it's not that easy. While NFL, NHL and NBA franchises are chomping at the bit to get going again, they're also deeply fearful of the legal implications of the decisions they are being asked to make. America is a deeply litigious society. While the fans are all demanding a return of live sporting action, many of the teams and leagues are worried that spectators or even players might file lawsuits if they end up getting COVID-19 as a result of any reopening. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican, represents the sports-mad state of Texas.
They don't want to be sued into oblivion, and they don't want to be responsible for a public health outbreak. They need some confidence that what they're doing won't get them in trouble, either legally or from a public health standpoint. They would love to have fans back in the stands, but I don't know what, if any of us know what that will look like.
No one does. But one thing's clear. Florida and a handful of other states say they're ready to welcome sports teams. But the teams are simply not ready for them. I'm Nina Maria Potts in Washington.
Next on the programme, we'll take you to Afghanistan, a country that's no stranger to brutality. But this week, the deadly attack there on a maternity ward has shaken everyone.
And we'll hear from the CEO of London's Heathrow Airport, normally Europe's busiest. Can it be again? That's all after the latest headlines and traffic. You're listening to CNA 938 World Report. I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
And I'm Benji Hyer in London. Now to Afghanistan, where at least five people died on Thursday when a truck packed with explosives blew up near a military court in the city of Gardez. The country was already reeling from Tuesday's attacks at a funeral and on a maternity ward in the capital, Kabul. Even by local standards, it appears to have set a new low and has drawn widespread condemnation. At least 24 people are known to have died there, including mothers, newborn babies and nurses. The rising tide of violence is also driving a wedge between the Taliban and the government, undermining the fragility of Afghanistan's peace efforts and dimming hopes for an end to decades of war. Earlier, I spoke to Mustafa Kazemi, a war veteran reporter who was at the hospital shortly after Tuesday's assault.
When you enter the site of the attack, the first things that you see when you enter the compound are bullet casings, spent bullet casings that are a sign of who was shooting at who. As you go ahead, you see bloodstains because the style of terrorist attacks in Afghanistan is as such that when the insurgents enter whatever compound they are attacking, they start shooting from the gate only, from the beginning of the door, and they shoot at whatever they see and come across. And just as we continued, pushed inside, we saw bodies on the ground, but they were packed in body bags. And the officials from the hospital were waiting for the relatives and next of kin of those people who lost their lives over there to come and collect them. There were two vehicles that were torched right on the courtyard of the hospital. There was a lady who was standing with one of the vehicles just around it when the insurgents had shot the fuel tank of the vehicle. And as it exploded, the lady was burned. And we tried to see if her face is recognizable. It was not. And later on, someone came and recognized her to claim her body from her feet only.
And has anyone so far claimed responsibility for this attack? The Taliban, of course, deny all involvement.
They did. In the initial hours of the attack, the Taliban sent a message on WhatsApp to some of the reporters saying that we got nothing to do with the attack in Kabul. We are not behind it. But the Afghan government said it's the Taliban, and they didn't accept the fact that the Taliban said they're not behind it. And following that, they started their offensive attacks against the Taliban.
And on that note, what's the political reaction been domestically from the president and also abroad?
Globally, we have barely seen anybody not condemning or not being shocked or moved by the attack. The Afghan president's first move was to come on the record on him in a video message saying that he condemns the attack, and following that, he says that we believe that this is done against all the goodwill and all the good gestures that we were trying to show to our enemy to bring peace to Afghanistan. And therefore, I am announcing and ordering all our military forces to go back into an offensive status and start attacking the enemy.
Finally, this all comes only months after a February troop withdrawal agreement signed between the United States and the Taliban. Since then, talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, which were aimed at ending almost two decades of war, have broken down. Following these attacks, any plans to bring peace to the country have surely suffered a major setback.
Well, I would say it's far more than a major setback. It is a complete halt and a nullification of all the efforts that were carried over the past year or so to bring peace in Afghanistan. Because just following the attack on the hospital, the Afghan president said But he actually broke that deal that that was being kept with the Taliban to bring peace in Afghanistan. Today, the Taliban said that since the government has said no to the offensive halt, we are also saying no to it, and this is our first attack. So basically, both parties indirectly pulled back from this peace agreement or the, you know, intention and the will to try to work to bring peace. And now Afghan government forces are going to attack the insurgents, especially the Taliban. And the Taliban are going to do the attacks both on the battlefield and in urban areas, because the terrorist attacks are happening in the cities and causing civilian damage and other destruction. So I'd say it's more than a setback. It's just a start and continuation of war in Afghanistan, and the coming weeks are going to be very bloody.
Mustafa Kazemi on the line earlier from Kabul. Finally, this Friday, it's been another awful week for the aviation industry, highlighted by Thursday's news that Singapore Airlines has posted its first ever financial loss after 48 years of flying. In London, Heathrow Airport was used by 206,000 travellers in the month of April, which is about the number it would normally host in a single day. And the airport has concerns about the British government's plans to quarantine international arrivals and says social distancing may not be a viable solution for the industry over the long term. Our London correspondent Ollie Barrett has been hearing from Heathrow's chief executive.
Heathrow's numbers are staggering. Europe's busiest airport in 2019, it is emphatically not busy right now, according to Chief Executive John Holland Kay.
The real story has been the complete collapse in revenues during March as people have effectively stopped flying because of the COVID crisis. And we have been staying open to make sure we have an air bridge so that the vital PPE that the NHS needs can still come into this country and that we can get people home, whether that is Brits from overseas wanting to come back to the UK or people who've been stuck in the UK who want to get back to their home market. So we're just staying open to be that vital air bridge for the UK. April 97% down on the previous year, and that just ties in with the kind of figures we've seen from Ryanair and BA. Effectively, markets are closed. Nobody is flying. Nobody's going on holiday at this time. We are just protecting cargo routes and repatriation.
Tuesday's GDP data show the UK is heading into a recession, even though it won't be confirmed until the next quarterly statistics. John Holland Kay says airports will play a crucial role in any recovery.
We have to look ahead to how will this open up again. And this is really vital because the Prime Minister's talked about getting the UK economic engine firing on all cylinders. Well, it can only do that if people are flying on aeroplanes. And the reason for that is that many of our industries in the UK rely on aviation. And you might not think about it in this way, but under your feet as you go on holiday, there are goods from the UK exporting to all over the world. There are imports coming in, which are the supply chain for UK manufacturers. And of course, we bring in all the tourists and the students who spend money here in the UK. So if we're going to get the economy moving, we need to get passengers flying again.
But aviation cannot recover without international cooperation, he says.
We've got to get this health crisis under control. But after that, we need to start thinking about how, in the time before we have a vaccine, we can get people flying again. And that's why I'm calling on the government to work on a common international standard for health in aviation, just as they did with security back in 2006. We need to have a way of making people feel safe to fly and confident that when they get to their destination, they're not going to be put into quarantine. And that's what I think we need to work on.
European airlines and airports are trying to get themselves moving again already. Low-cost European carrier Ryanair, for example, announced this week it wants to run 40% of its original schedule of flights from July, and it's predicting essentially open skies from around September. But how do we get to that point, and what will airports look like in the future? John Holland Kay is sceptical that safe distancing measures can work in his sector over the long term.
I think many of the measures people are talking about are completely unviable in any normal course of business. Now, they might be needed in the first in the next couple of months, but we need to be looking 3 or 4 months ahead to something that will work. And if you remember when the ban on laptop liquids came in, then there were long queues of security. And it took us a little while to deal with that and come up with a process that we're now you can fly through security in a minute or two. The same thing I think will happen with the kind of health screening. And you may not notice it, but if you ever fly into an Asian airport, there are health checks that take place every day, have done ever since SARS. You don't even notice them. So I think that is where we will get to with aviation. So I think this will be part of a package of measures. I suspect that we will have temperature checks perhaps as you come into the terminal so that you know that if you have a temperature, you're not going to be able to fly, you don't come to the airport, but also that anyone within the airport is a low-risk person. And then I think there'll be very good hygiene measures as you go through. There'll be less contact between airport workers and passengers because we'll be using more digital technology, more automation. We'll have very good hygiene going through the airport. I don't think social distancing will work in aviation or in any other transport sector because people are much more condensed together. And if we're going to get the airport and aviation system working and get the economy flowing, we need some of these alternative measures to just social distancing.
Environmental campaigners say the world needs to fly less and are pressing their hope that global air travel does fall as a result of this outbreak. But the airlines that use Heathrow are under huge financial strain already, with many thousands of jobs at risk. One of its biggest customers is BA. But John Holland Kay is hopeful that even if British Airways reduces operations from the airport long term, that may open up opportunities elsewhere.
We know that we've got lots of airlines who've always wanted to be able to fly into Heathrow. And if we can get the a safe way for people to fly in the next few months, as we're calling for today, then we even if British Airways pulls out some of its flights from Heathrow, we will see new airlines coming in, connecting Britain to the world, and making sure we can get the UK economy firing on all cylinders.
Firing on all cylinders may well be optimistic. It could be a long haul yet. Ollie Barrett, London.
And that's our programme for this morning and for the week. We'll be back on Monday at 6 a.m. I'm Benji Hyer in London.
And I'm Simon Marks in Washington. On Monday, I'll be hosting a roundtable conversation about the perilous future of the US-China relationship. Join us for that and all the other big global stories making news. But stand by now for Arnold and Yasmin. They're next with Asia First. From all of us, have a great weekend.